From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. The story of business dynamism in America is a story of entrepreneurship. At least, it was. Silicon Valley is still hopping with entrepreneurs, but nationally, the numbers on new business creation and turnover are down. That's a big deal for our economy, society, jobs, dreams. This hour on Point, where are the American entrepreneurs? You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. Why aren't Americans starting businesses all over the place like they used to? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me first today from Washington is Danielle Kurtzleben, economics writer for Vox.com. She's taking a look at the latest trends in entrepreneurship. Danielle, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
Big study out of the Brookings Institution looking at this. And what are the numbers? What's got them worried, Danielle?
Right. Well, what has them worried is a figure called the firm entry rate. Now, this is a figure that talks about the share of firms that are less than 1 year old in the economy. And what they've shown is that this has fallen, and it's not just a recessionary thing. And I think that's one of the big things that they're pointing out that is a little bit troubling. So in 1978, that figure was around 14 or 15%. So 14 to 15% of U.S. firms in that year were less than a year old. Today, it's around 8%. So that's a drop of almost half.
That's an enormous drop. And you report, as the study finds, it is truly national. It's everywhere, and it's more or less in every sector.
Very much, yeah. I mean, they really go into depth here. They look at more than 300 metropolitan areas. They look at all of the states, and they find that, you know, firm exit rates, the number of firms that are, that are falling out, that are ending business, those are holding relatively steady and have for the last 30-ish years. The recession did tick that up a bit, but still it's held relatively steady. But firm entry rates have dropped across all states, almost all metros, and it's also fallen across industries and across different firm sizes as well. It's really widespread.
I'm looking at agriculture, mining, construction, manufacturing, transportation, wholesale, retail, services, right on down the line. Even Silicon Valley, which is still pins the needle, San Francisco area and beyond there for new firm creation, but even it compared to where it was, down.
Right, absolutely. And that's also what's surprising, right? Because that's a stereotype we have of Silicon Valley, isn't it? You know, that there are all of these new startups happening all the time.
Well, and there are a lot, but it's just not quite what it was even there.
Exactly. And that's really what's fascinating about this as well. You're absolutely right.
What's the importance of this?
Well, the importance of this is that this sort of churn is the way to talk about it. It's, the official term is business dynamism, but the really idea is, a churn is, new firms replacing old firms, new workers replacing old workers, moving from job to job and learning more skills. That is essential to economic growth. That is really important. The economics term is creative destruction. The idea is, think of the personal computer, The typewriter is replaced by the word processor, is replaced by, the personal computer eventually. And what it does is it boosts productivity. You can do more with less goods, more with less people. And that means you have so much more room for growth. If you're not replacing businesses, if you're not moving workers around, the idea is that, this really could put a crimp on growth.
What's the theory or theories behind why we see less active business creation, churn, entrepreneurship? Is it business consolidation? We've got great big firms. I don't know, Walmart or Amazon, you can buy everything there now. So why start a mom and pop shop? Or is it government red tape? Or what's going on?
Honestly, all of those have been thrown out. You do hear, there was a survey released this week, actually, by the National Federation of Independent Business, which is a small business association. And you do hear some of those small firms say, we feel that what's hindering us is government regulation. They say taxes, all sorts of things. Now, this Brookings report doesn't get into exactly the whys, but one thing it does note is that, especially in the wake of the recession, there is a very risk-averse atmosphere right now. People are reluctant to spend money. Large businesses are even reluctant to spend money, right? We always hear that they're sitting on these piles of cash. And that might also transfer into the firm creation area, that would-be entrepreneurs are simply not starting firms because it's still a relatively shaky economic atmosphere out there.
You write, you quote one of the authors of this report saying there's something in the zeitgeist, there's something in risk aversion that's getting worse, risk aversion throughout the economy, big companies sitting on piles of cash, big banks sitting on piles of cash, and I guess potential would be entrepreneurs, startup men and women sitting on their ambition here. I wonder if there's a cultural change, Danielle, that it's just somehow not as cool or inviting to get out and put your, put it on the line with a startup.
That's altogether possible. Although one thing I do find interesting about this is that there are various surveys of millennials, young people, in their 20s and up to barely early 30s, which does say, you do have a lot of young people who really do say, I would like to be an entrepreneur. Mm-hmm. I would like to be my own boss. I would like to start my own business. So from what I have read, it sounds like the drive is there. It's just that the certainty is not. I mean, when the author of the report did tell me, it's something in the zeitgeist, that's altogether possible. It's just so hard to quantify, and it's so hard, of course, to put your finger on and pin down.
Interesting element here. Immigrants have always been big entrepreneurs in this country, but lately people look even more toward immigrants to take advantage of that opportunity more than native-born Americans.
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely true, and this is something that the Brookings people did point to say this is how we could boost entrepreneurship, is we can bring in more high-skilled immigrants, because often those people really do start new firms. Another thing they also point to is the idea of business accelerators and business incubators. These are programs that often for a share of the equity in a new business will help a new business get off the ground. For example, a business incubator called Y Combinator was the launching point of Dropbox and Airbnb. Those are things that a lot of us know of. And the reasons that they are so successful, you could say, is that these sorts of programs help them through the process.
Business accelerators and immigrants, though you'd like that impulse and its benefits to be flowing to a very wide swath of this society, the benefits of that entrepreneurship down markedly over the last 30 years, almost by half, Danielle Kurtzleben reminds us. She's with Vox.com. Danielle, thank you very much for being with us today.
Absolutely. Thank you, Tom.
With me now from New York is Ray Hennessy, editorial director of Entrepreneurship.com. His article, Why Americans Don't Want to Start New Businesses, came out just last week. Ray, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Tom.
And with us from Washington, Lena Khan, policy analyst for the Markets, Enterprise, and Resiliency Initiative at the New America Foundation. She co-authored the 2012 Washington Monthly piece, The Slow Motion Collapse of American Entrepreneurship. Lena Khan, thank you for joining us today.
Hi, Tom.
Ray, let's look at whys here. Why do you think this is happening? Why the slowdown? This is supposed to be a hallmark of American culture, the American economy. What's up with the slowdown?
It is interesting when we talk about the zeitgeist, because I think there is a tone that's changed. And in talking to current business owners, who I think are a good barometer of the people who would otherwise be starting businesses, we are finding that it's regulation. It's not just the pace and number of regulations. And I know, people throw out numbers about how there's a new regulation promulgated every 2.5 hours in this country. We should have a larger regulatory framework because we have a larger business framework. But I think it's the nature of that regulation that has people very concerned. If you look at the sharing economy, Tom, so companies like Uber and Lyft that do car sharing services, they're finding problems because regulators are going after them on behalf of local taxi companies. So you have these innovations in some businesses that are coming up against regulation. You see, Danielle mentioned Airbnb as a company that here in New York is facing a lot of problems with the current regulatory structure because the hotel industry is fighting them. So, when regulation changes from something that protects consumers to something that protects competitors, it makes it more difficult for somebody to sit down and innovate and try to create a company about that. Because the access to capital has never been better. I know a lot of people like to complain about big banks and how they keep businesses down and they hurt the little guy. But the truth is that very few companies are complaining about a lack of access to credit. Companies can borrow money. They can also raise money with not only these accelerator programs, but incubator programs and with crowdfunding, and there's more money to be put to work to start a business than ever before. It really is just the attitude, and we hear it in more subtle ways, Tom. When you think about after the President's State of the Union address, he immediately went out and talked about how workers needed to be paid more at larger corporations. And when you hear a tone, you hear a tone that business is somehow keeping workers down. Business is to blame for higher unemployment. Business is to blame for higher costs of goods and services. And when you hear that and you're trying to develop a small business, I think there are a lot of people who just don't want to be bothered. They say, you know, one of the myths of entrepreneurship.
Hey, Ray, hold that thought. I want to get Lena in before the break here. And we just got a minute, Lena. But there's the red tape and regulation argument. There's another part to this argument that's about business consolidation. If Walmart sells everything, what's a mom and pop shop supposed to sell? What about that side of the, I don't know, concern equation here, Lena? What do you see causing the slowdown?
So I think this is a complicated issue. You know, there are obviously multiple factors at play, but I think one of the most dramatic changes we've seen in our political economy over the last 30 years is the dramatic consolidation. So, you know, in industry after industry, where we once had a lot of competition, we saw a lot of more or less equally sized players. We now instead see markets increasingly dominated by just a handful of big companies. And, you know, you mentioned Walmart, and yeah, that's a great example. You know, 30 years ago, you had, you know, thousands of grocery stores owned by families, and today, I think Walmart controls like 30% of that market. In sub-metropolitan areas, it's 50%. So that's business that was, you know, dispersed that has now been consolidated. And with that, the whole ecosystem has really changed to support the big and not so much the new.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour about American entrepreneurship, new business creation, declining, bigger, older businesses, holding firmer in the economy. Silicon Valley looks hot for the new, but most of the country lately does not. We're asking why. The Silicon Valley dream is still out there. You've got a TV show, new HBO show, centers on tech geeks looking to make it big. Here's a bidding war in the show, breaking out over a piece of a new company.
This is Richard. I'll give you $3 million for it right now.
Gavin Belson just offered me $3 million for Pied Piper.
I'm prepared to give you $300,000.
Peter Gregory just offered me $300,000. Did you say thousand?
For 10% of your company.
Okay, $4
million. $200,000 for 5%.
Huh? You just went down.
No. You're still valued at $4 million, but you own 95% of a potential billion-dollar company.
From HBO's Silicon Valley, all the buzzy about the billions. But a lot of people look out there and they see big competition. Here's an advertisement for Walmart. They claim to have everything you need. You don't have to shop anywhere else.
Summer is here and it's time for Walmart's Summer of Savings event. With thousands of items on clearance and rollback, Walmart has everything you need to start this season right. Summer's short, so make it count with Walmart's Summer of Savings event going on right now.
We're at 800-423-8255 with Lena Khan from the New America Foundation, Ray Hennessy from Entrepreneur.com. Lena, you're saying business consolidation, great big competitors may be the problem. Haven't there always been big businesses in this country that newcomers had to compete with if they wanted to get in the game?
Sure. I think, you know, it's interesting we've been talking about regulation because I think in terms of like one of the biggest regulatory changes we've seen over the last 30 years, it's that there's been a drastic decline in enforcement of antitrust laws. So traditionally, we had a very robust antitrust regime that made sure that, you know, marketplaces stayed open, they stayed fair, they stayed competitive, and they usually curbed the power of any single one big company. So for example, we used to have things like predatory pricing laws, which prevented an existing company from, you know, drastically cutting prices to try and push out a newcomer. Or, you know, we had something called the Robinson-Patman Act, which limited how much a company could squeeze suppliers. So we had all these laws that really were intended and did effectively keep marketplaces open and competitive and ensured that newcomers had a fair shot. And all of those, because of certain political changes in the 80s, you know, the Reagan administration rewrote antitrust laws, those are not enforced in the same way today. And I think we are seeing to some degree the effects of that.
Ray, I want to bring that to you as well. Let me begin to bring our listeners in. Judy in Milwaukee. Judy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
I opened my doors of a knitting and yarn shop 3 years ago in a small rural community an hour and a half north of Milwaukee, and I'm opening a second business currently in the city of Milwaukee proper, selling really high-quality fabrics and yarns.
Okay.
I think the problem with entrepreneurs is multifactorial. I think you have to be at a very unique place in your life. I'm a critical care nurse turned entrepreneur. What I see is that my husband supports me and my family, and my kids are grown. You have to have somebody supporting you. It's going to take years before, I mean, granted, my business did make a profit, which is unusual, but it certainly wasn't a profit enough to support myself. It's going to take years to realize any kind of money or any kind of profit.
Judy, it's never been a snap. It's never been an overnight thing, as I'm sure you know. What do you think makes it tougher now? Are you up against competition from, let's say, online sales when you want to sell yarn and knitting supplies, fabrics?
Very, very much so. Very much so up against Amazon for books and patterns and things like that. So you have to get creative. There are lots of free patterns you can offer, and you have to be, you have much more creativity now as a small mom-and-pop kind of operation. But the other thing I see, like I said, I was a critical care nurse turned entrepreneur, is that I think my generation is maybe one of the last ones to want to work this hard. I see the younger nurses not really wanting to work hard. They don't want the hard assignments, and I see that in just my world around me. People don't want to work this hard to make a little bit of money.
And starting a new business is definitely hard work. Ray Hennessy, what about this, the internet as a kind of omni-competitor to every new business out there, making it harder for little guys, gals, to get going? What do you think about that, Ray?
Well, I think it's less of a competitor than it's an opportunity. So Judy can sell yarn to me in New York from her shop in the Midwest.
But so can Amazon, and presumably at a lower price.
But look, I kind of reject the idea that this consolidation in a number of companies, like the Walmartization of the country, is shutting out retailers. I think what you found in retail in particular is a rise in specialty retailers. So when Walmart comes into an area, there's it's a very homogenous product line that they sell. You know, you can go into that Walmart in one state and a Walmart in another, and for the most part, you're getting the same things. But the need and the desire to have things that Walmart doesn't carry, I view as a business opportunity. So yes, you have these big competitors out there, but what you're finding is companies can get into these markets and they can sell things that these big competitors don't have. They can market them differently and in a neat and interesting way. Or they can partner with some of these big competitors and use them as a sales opportunity. So the opportunity to innovate around the competition is there, and history's full of examples. I always go back when someone tells me about big competition, I always point out that coronary stents in the early 90s mm-hmm. were developed by Johnson & Johnson, you know, a very, very large
yep.
healthcare company. And they pretty much own the market until a tiny little startup company called Arterial Vascular Engineering, Inc., came up with a better stent and essentially took all the market share away from Johnson & Johnson. It can happen. Apple changed the way that the music industry operates. Now, Apple was a larger company, but it was the idea of how we buy music and how we listen to digital music that really changed the music industry for forever.
Yeah, so I mean, it can happen. We know that the numbers are down, though. We see that. Lena Ray says, again, red tape and bureaucracy getting in the way here. If it's consolidation, why? I mean, we see he says you can open a specialty shop even if you've got Walmart in your neighborhood. We do see lots of sort of smaller companies catering to the locavore movement, you know, goat cheese and all the rest. Aren't there always new opportunities, even if there are big players out there, Lena?
Sure. There are some niche opportunities. You know, it's interesting. I was doing an article a couple months ago looking at the candy industry. So that's somewhere we started seeing some new business growth. But talking to some of the businesses, they were saying, you know, it's very difficult because it's not just, you know, Mars and Hershey that are dominant in that space, but the entire supply chain has consolidated in a way where, you know, both the sugar and cocoa processors are giant. The trucking companies are huge. You know, it's really difficult to even secure shelf space, you know, in a store. You know, it's interesting you mentioned Amazon being able to partner with them because a lot of marketplace sellers do sell there. But one of their complaints is that, you know, oftentimes they'll have a niche product. So, you know, there's this guy who was selling these great vacuum cleaners that started doing really well. Nobody else was selling them on Amazon. Because he was selling them on Amazon's platform, Amazon was able to spot that they were doing really well, ended up going directly to to the manufacturer, buying them from them and undercutting him and putting him out of business on that product. So, you know, I think some of these platforms do provide great opportunities, but especially now that many of them center around data and how data can be used, it's going to be really important that we regulate these markets to ensure that, you know, they stay fair and open.
Lena Khan, Ray Hennessy, stand by. Nancy Kane joins us right now from Belmont, Massachusetts, historian, professor of business administration at the Harvard Business School. Her work focuses on entrepreneurial leadership. Nancy Kane, welcome to On Point. Always great to have you.
Hey, Tom. Great to be here.
This seems like a big deal given this country's economic history. Entrepreneurs played a big role in that. Not everybody is going to be an entrepreneur. Not everybody even likes that neck of the woods, but a lot of jobs created over the world and a lot of innovation. If these numbers are down, does it matter?
Oh, I think so. And I have to say that, you know, we've talked a lot in years past about different kinds of phenomena, and I'm always the kind of harumphing historian saying, well, I'm not sure there's anything really new here, you know, if we look back far enough. This seems, you know, 1978 to 2011, 2012, that's a big deal. That's a long time, and all kinds of things happened, right? Business cycles rose and fell, you know, a big recession came and lifted to somewhat, and still, you cut this data every which way. You do it with Brookings, you do it with Kauffman, the Kauffman Foundation, and you still get, you know, an ongoing and steepening, in the case of, you know, the last, they say 6 years, steepening decline in entrepreneurial activity. I think it's a big deal. I think it's a big deal at a lot of levels, job creation, innovative, productive disruption. But I think it's a big deal at a cultural or, you know, zeitgeist level because, you know, America has always been, right, from the first ships, Carl Daigler, a great grand old man of American history, said in the early in the 20th century, capitalism came in the first ships. And that kind of can-do, make-it-up-as-you-go-along, do-something-different has always been an important part of not only the American economy, American society, but, you know, what the historian James Truslow Adams would coin the term the American dream in, you know, the early 1930s. So I think at both a micro and a macro level, culturally as well as economically, this is a big deal.
I mean, it's still
we've got all the causes here kind of laid out.
No, I want to look at those causes in more depth, but Nancy, it's still capitalism if it's big companies playing, right?
Absolutely, Tom. It is capitalism. But what Daigler meant was the pilgrims came over. Mm-hmm. Half of them were looking to make more money on their own outside of an established, more hierarchical system in Europe. And they were disruptors, right? And that aspect, what's the great definition of entrepreneurship? I think it may have come out of the entrepreneurship work at HBS many years ago. Entrepreneurs are individuals, right, who are opportunity-driven rather than resource-constrained, right? Individuals who relentlessly pursue opportunity and then build something out of that opportunity. That's a very, very important source of energy, job creation, you know, the beginnings of big business. Apple Computer was just a glint in the eyes of Steve Jobs and Steve Wozniak in 1975. So out of the kind of activity that we're talking about come the mainstays, right, the pillars of our economy, of other economies. And so for this to be a slowdown is interesting, and I think, again, you know, somewhat worrisome, because not only what it means right now, but what does it portend 20, 30 years from now?
Doesn't it seem strange to you, Nancy, that this slowdown, the falling almost by half of the firm entry rate from the 70s up to this is through 2011, and that's come in the same period where entrepreneurs have received a heck of a lot of attention and limelight and, you know, venture capital and money. I mean, Silicon Valley became gigantic in the 90s, not to mention before, looking down from 30,000 feet, one would have thought we were in an entrepreneurial heyday.
I couldn't agree more, Tom. And I thought about, you know, the go-go days before the first big, you know, if you will, internet bubble in 2000 and 2001. I thought about teaching at HBS. We could, you know, we had students like starting businesses in between classes.
Yeah.
And everywhere you looked, people were trying to start their own company. And yet, you know, the way you cut this data, it doesn't matter whether you look at different cities or except with the exception of Silicon Valley and a few other places, the decline is steady, right? And unmistakable. And so I think that is just very, very interesting. There were these cycles and regional pockets that exist today of extraordinarily important entrepreneurial activity, but overall, across cities, across states, across most demographic groups, entrepreneurial activity has fallen.
Nancy Kane, Ray Hennessy, Lena Khan, please stand by. Keith is calling from Nashville, Tennessee. Keith, you're on the air. What do you see happening?
Hi, Tom. I don't think it's a problem with American character. I think there's a real fear issue out there. Regulation is expensive and hard to navigate. So if you run afoul of that, I think people are afraid of getting sued.
Just living in a more litigious society, a more regulated society, I mean, there's always been some of that concern there. Keith, you couldn't start a business without taking on some responsibility alongside that.
Well, yeah, but I think that probably scares people off, even if you have a competitive idea or product.
Yeah, Keith, thanks for your call. Nancy Kane, Ray Hennessy points right away to regulation. You know, here comes Uber and Airbnb, and suddenly you've got people who want to regulate them to protect incumbent industries. Keith looks even more broadly at fear about legal responsibility and red tape. How big a role do you see that playing?
Oh, I think that's always got, it's always got a role. But, you know, again, historically, one of the main arguments that has been used to explain these bursts of entrepreneurial activity in America, you know, from, say, 1850 on in the beginnings of industrialization is that in America, at least on the failure side, on the bankruptcy side, it was actually easier to fail in this country legally than it was in other places, and that made people less afraid or less risk-averse. So, you know, that's been, that difference has been mitigated and you know, shrunk over the last, you know, 60 or 70 years. But again, there's been regulation in place in with regard to all kinds of businesses of different sizes since the early 20th century. So has it suddenly become much more stringent and rigorous? And that is in a sense up in the fear temperature. That seems to me like an important but not sufficient explanation.
Ray, would you call it suddenly much more stringent regulation, enough that it could account for such a large fall off in new firm creation?
I think what we have is a failure to adapt in the regulatory framework to new innovation. And in the past, I think people have looked at new innovation and said, you know what, this is good for us. Let's move from the government standpoint to accommodate new innovation. And I think, you know, Google is a perfect example of a company that's kind of struggling with two innovations that are running up against a regulatory framework that won't budge. One is with Google Glass, where you can't wear Google Glass when you drive. People are issued tickets in California because there are laws on the books against watching television when you drive an automobile. And you know, Google has said, well, this isn't television and it's Google Glass and this is what it is. But the way the law is interpreting it is that you can't do that. And they're also kind of at the cutting edge of these self-driving cars. Well, guess what? The insurance regulations by state need you to have a driver for a car. You can't be in a self-driving car. And there's a hesitancy within the regulatory framework. And that's on a state-by-state basis since insurance is regulated by state.
But you wouldn't say anything goes, would you? I mean, what if Google Glass turns out to be a driving risk? I mean, isn't there room for...
Absolutely. And as I said before, it's. I think the bigger issue is the changing nature of regulation, which is more about protecting the incumbent and competitor rather than protecting the consumer. And that's what you're seeing more of the newer regulations doing, particularly when it comes to new companies and being created. And I'm sure
Ray
Hennessy,
stand by there at entrepreneur.com. Lena Khan at the New America Foundation. Nancy Kane from Harvard Business School. We're talking about American entrepreneurship declining and asking why. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. We're talking this hour about American entrepreneurship, new business creation declining. Silicon Valley looks hot. Most of the country does not these days. New business creation dropped by nearly half since the 1970s. We're asking why and what the implications of that might be. Of course, it's been part of American culture, pretty much forever, as Nancy Kane says. She's with us from Harvard Business School. Ray Hennessy's here from Entrepreneur.com. Lena Kahn is with us from the New America Foundation. 1953, I Love Lucy. Just, it's in the air. It's in the culture. Lucy and Ethel test their entrepreneurial spirits, start a dress shop here. Don't have much luck.
This is a pretty pickle. We've been open 2 whole days and haven't seen a customer. We made 5 sales. Yes, to each other. And I think we should have investigated our credit before we opened those charge accounts.
And maybe so. It's still in the air. It's in the culture. Shark Tank on ABC. Entrepreneurs pitch their businesses to a panel of investors. In this episode, Robert Haverjek offers $500,000 for a 25% stake in Oru Kayak. The company owner, Anton Willis, counters.
Would you take 20%?
No. Guys, if it's worth it to you at 20, it's worth it to you at 25. $500,000 is a lot of money.
Yeah.
That's my offer. I'm not trying to, negotiate you out of it. That's the offer I feel comfortable with.
All right. Well. We'd love to have you. And we are.
All right. Wow.
Shark Tank. ABC thinks it's out there. Knows there's an appetite, I guess, from their viewer ratings on it. And the hit it big, strike it rich idea is still out there, though sometimes humorously hear from NBC's Parks and Recreation. Ben Wyatt, played by Adam Scott, visits with 2 employees from a tech startup in Silicon Valley named Grizzle. Ask them about their success.
Wow, so Grizzle's really taken off, huh?
Yeah, it's been a crazy ride. Our music service Grizzle Dump launched in November, and now we have 170 million users.
6 months ago, I was working in a taco truck. Now, I own 1/3 of the Portland Trailblazers.
We know that idea is out there, and yet the numbers are down nationally. Why do you think that is? Is it about red tape? Is it about overwhelming competition, business consolidation? Has something changed in the environment, the culture, the system that makes it harder? Let me go to Joe in Framingham, Massachusetts. Joe, you're on the air. Thanks for your call.
Tom, talking from a PBS documentary on the death of Main Street, that predatory model which Walmart uses is right to the point. The way they can go into a town and basically give away a section, let's say the hardware, then the paint, until those stores are gone. That is what small business is facing. Now, on that folding kayak, by the way, there's a company called Fallbot. Since 1936, they've been making a folding boat, and I'm surprised that wasn't brought up. But I'm off air. Thank you.
Right. Joe, thanks for your call. Nancy, Lena raised business consolidation and big competition from great big chains out there, Walmart and more. What about that? Is it just a tougher environment for small folks to get in and plant their flag?
So again, the American landscape, since big business arrived in the 1850s, if you think of department stores as being huge retailers at the time, all the way, through Standard Oil and Ford Motor Company and the rise of Walgreens and Rexall Drugs,
yeah,
which were considered the Walmart of their time. The first major hunk of retail antitrust legislation, to Lena's point earlier, was raised against those players on the part of mom and pop. So I hate to sound like, nothing new under the sun, but that too is not new, and it's not to take anything away from what Joe's talking about, but it's not new.
Even I remember changes way beyond what happened when Walgreens occurred, when Walmart came to town, when they sold everything from car tires,
sure,
tractor tires, to, baby food, and the local tire distributor went out of business. Wasn't that different in kind?
Well, yeah, it was. But remember that all that Walmart started as a gleam in the eye of an entrepreneur named Sam Walton, right? And the specialty retailers that had grown up were entrepreneurial, enterprises and inventions in themselves. I mean, so when Schumpeter says, mm-hmm, talks about creative destruction, right, that, the biological term in which, structures are destroyed from within and then create new ones, that's what he's talking about. And what's interesting about this work, which measures, by the way, business creation,
mm-hmm,
we're not capturing people reinventing themselves that don't incorporate themselves.
Yep.
So we're that part of entrepreneurial work, which is important, and probably much more widespread than we have any measure of, isn't captured here. But the growth, what is captured here is that the growth of the creative part of creative destruction seems to be declining relative to the death of businesses. So, so that again is very, very interesting, and over 30 years, somewhat new.
Lena Khan, there was Standard Oil, there was Walgreens. Are you making the case that there's something different in the big, big players now that, that puts a blockage in the system when it comes to new business creation?
No, absolutely not. Nancy is right. You know, we've been through eras of this before. You know, there were so many protests against A&P because it was doing the exact same thing. It was just shuttering out business after business. I think there are a couple of things that are different. You know, one is that we did, in the wake of those fights, end up passing laws that didn't even necessarily break up these companies, but curbed their power. So I think one of the big things is, you know, it's not so much that these small businesses are facing overwhelming competition from these massive companies. It's that there is no competition. When players get so big, the entire playing field tilts in a way that it's just much harder to even get something off the ground. So yeah, I mean, I think, you know, Walmart as like is a fantastic creation, and the fact that it came out of, you know, this one single entrepreneur is amazing. I think the question is, you know, when do these kinds of companies become so dominant that they are then squelching the possibility of that next fantastic creation? So I think that's the kind of thing we need to be asking now.
George in Evansville, Indiana. George, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi.
Hi.
I was just listening earlier, and one of the things, I am a entrepreneur. I've started multiple companies and sold my last one. One of the things I found is that I was selling as a supplier to people who were starting companies, their equipment, as well as their supplies. And one of the things I kept on seeing is that there were many people that were ill-prepared to go into these small businesses, that they had a little dream. Somebody told them it was a great idea. You have such a little, you know, talent here. Maybe you ought to build something into that.
Yeah, yeah.
But what they don't really do is put the infrastructure in place. And they, you'd think that if they have one shot at it, that they ought to be doing as much as they can. I know I made that mistake myself, and I had to regroup from it. And even now, as I'm looking at a very interesting prospect, two in particular, and one I'm probably pursuing, instead of trying to reach out to other people, I'm building a war chest to be able to do that, and I'm putting the plans in place with good, competent individuals. And I don't think it's done. I think it just takes a lot more planning to succeed. If you really want to win, you got to put everything in place to win.
George, we've got it. Let me take that to Ray Hennessy at entrepreneur.com. Ray, you see a lot of stories. What about this? Is it possible that there's just less know-how in the society somehow? People aren't as familiar with doing it.
Yeah, I mean, there's always been less know-how, and that's not bad. I mean, when you think of the story of American entrepreneurship, the words luck come up a lot and the word failure comes up a lot, right? And I think a lot of people who were ill-prepared to start a business failed. And I think history is also filled with a lot of people who were ill-prepared to succeed. And because I think there is that luck being in the right place in the right time. I think it's the attitude, right? I mean, I want ill-prepared people to start businesses because you want them to feel like that's a path for success for them. I mean, and I think that that's what's missing here. I think that you want people – it doesn't matter whether you went to business school, whether or not you know the basic blocking and tackling of finances and everything. If you have a good idea, you try to bring that to market. You try to sell it to people. And sometimes it's going to work. More often than not, it's going to fail. I think one of the things with the Brookings data that was so kind of concerning to me is it's not that the failure rate is rising or falling. It's pretty much steady. It's that people just aren't taking that risk. They're not taking that chance. And it comes, you know, when you look at some broader other economic data and you look at, say, the labor force participation rate, where workers are working at a lower rate than they have historically since the 1970s as well. You have to start saying that there's something attitudinal in the country too that needs to be addressed.
That is so interesting. Nancy, one second. Let me get Dave in Trumbull, Connecticut, and I'll come right to you. Dave, you're on.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
My thought on this is that it's the decline of the middle class over the last few decades. You need capital to start businesses and to keep them going through the first few years where you don't make money. And there's no capital in the middle class these days. So it's very difficult for someone, even if they have a good idea, to go out there and start a business.
What about that, Nancy Kena? So, what was I reading? Six sisters in the Walton family have as much wealth as 40% of the of the country. What about the loss of the middle class? Is that a factor?
I think that's a piece of it too, and it speaks to this attitudinal shift that is harder to measure, but I think just can absolutely not be dismissed here that Ray is talking about. So one other piece of data that's interesting in the Brookings work that speaks to what Ray is talking about and what Dave in Connecticut is talking about is relocation. People aren't moving at anything like the rates they did, say, in the 1960s and the 1950s, all the way to the Dust Bowl and all the way certainly back into the 19th century. And that's interesting, too, because that, again, speaks to a sense of what is our possibility around over the next hill or on the next frontier? And again, you look at the squeezing of the middle class is astoundingly rapid and seemingly irrevocable increase in inequality. And what does that mean for people's sense of what they can do, how they can disrupt, how they can create, how they can apply themselves? Because, you know, as our nurse said, right, in the Midwest, work ethic is sweat equity is about 90% of this. You just have to stay the course, and it's really hard. And so I think all these things add up to at least a real, very significant possibility that people don't have the same kind of sense of possibility that they did, you know, half a century ago. And that's a big deal.
BB is calling from Montgomery, Alabama. Hi, BB, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. I just wondered if your guests would comment on the role that urban sprawl and the lack of walkable communities might be having on the decline of small businesses. I mean, it wouldn't affect tech biz, but like an art shop, or if I'd like to move back to my hometown of Mobile and start selling upcycled art and such, so, I don't see a walkable community where that would be viable.
So even suburban sprawl where the big box might dominate. Lena Khan, what do you think about that idea?
Yeah, it's an interesting question for sure. You know, I do think that sprawl has probably contributed, you know, especially there are so many rural communities where you do have, you know, very dominant companies that make it difficult. I think, you know, the internet is not trivial. I think it has opened up a lot of opportunities for people, and it's just a question of, you know, can we keep these platforms open and equitable?
I mean, I wonder, though, the flip side of the suburban sprawl is there's a lot of urbanization going on again now. And in urban areas and beyond, there's so much talk about locavore consumption and production. I mean, I'm surprised that doesn't show up somewhere in these numbers. We hear a lot about it, Lena. Maybe it's just not got enough actual weight in the numbers to show up.
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I think this is a great opening for there to be a much bigger conversation. You know, I think the gentleman's point about how it's, you know, the erosion of the middle class that is really contributing to this, I think that's a huge factor. I think, you know, it seems like inequality is both contributing to this, but that this is also going to implicate it. You know, I mean, traditionally, entrepreneurship was also just a way to disperse a lot of wealth and power within the country. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a country that is composed of, you know, 5,000 CEOs looks very different from a country composed of 50 or 5. So I think, you know, it's a cultural question, it's an economic question, but it's also a political question. And it's very troubling. And I do hope that this is going to kind of open the door to more research and study on this.
Nancy, if we wanted to address it politically, where would you look to press the levers?
You got to do something about immigration reform, right? Because immigrants start businesses and their kids start businesses in much higher numbers than native-born Americans.
So but we have a lot of immigrants.
Yeah, well, we need more, right? And we need the lab to come and stay here. So that's an important button. Lots of people agree on that. Our constipated Congress hasn't been able to do anything about that very effectively. But I think there are other things that are important, too. So if you think about government-sponsored research and development, not a sizzly topic, but very, very important for all kinds of bursts of entrepreneurial activity, all the way, you know, from the jet airplane and the technology that spawned to, you know, early in government investment in semiconductors and mainframe computers to, you know, the early versions of the internet, which were the results of government-sponsored research and development. So one of the very, very real and important and yet not obvious repercussions of a constipated, right, cash-poor federal government is that we are pulling all kinds of money out of the system that fed inventiveness and product possibilities and disruptive innovation at the private sector. So that's another area that's much easy to talk about, hard to do when we have a federal government that doesn't function very effectively at the legislative and executive levels.
Ray Hennessy, what do you see generationally here? Younger Americans coming up now, more entrepreneurially oriented or less?
Actually, I hate to disagree with Danielle, who started the conversation mm-hmm. for us an hour ago, mm-hmm. but we've found that millennials are less likely to want to start a business. And there's some data that is still being crunched about that. And, I think you had the baby boom generation that seemed more likely. And I think just like we're seeing that work through in the broader unemployment data, I wouldn't be surprised if we didn't see some effect of, generational effect in driving these numbers. I would have thought that since people are living longer and they're not retiring, that there would be an opportunity to start new businesses and you'd see more business creation. We aren't. So I do think there are some generational factors at work here that can't be dismissed.
Nancy, just got 20 seconds here. Has the impulse gone elsewhere? Is the entrepreneurial spirit, I don't know, in Canada, in China, has it left the building?
I don't think it's left the building completely, but it certainly caught fire in other countries.
Wow. Well, we will be watching for the implications of all that. We may be seeing and living in some of them already. Dramatic numbers on business creation in this country, implications on the innovation front, the job creation front, and as we've heard today, culturally. I want to thank all three of you for your insights. Nancy Kane at the Harvard Business School. Nancy, wonderful to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Tom.
Lena Khan at the New America Foundation joined us from Washington. Lena, thanks for being here.
Thank you.
And Ray Hennessy at Entrepreneur.com. Thanks so much, Ray.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thanks for all your input. Check out the comments online. Very interesting. I'm onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.